Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Not only does it help grow the show and keep it on the top true crime charts, but it also makes me feel so loved and appreciated. So thank you guys. This story has it all. Celebrity, money, fame, sex, scandal, sadly abuse, sadly crime, and also the most sad, murder. This is the story of O.J. Simpson and everyone in his orbit. But it is also very much the story of the victims, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, the two who were brutally murdered that fateful day in 1994. We are going to discuss the lives of the victims that ended much too early, but we are also going to start from the beginning, with the man at the center of it all, O.J. Simpson. The aim is not for this to be hero worship, but you can't tell this story without explaining where it all began with O.J., who was, to most of America, an American hero. But in the hushed corners of American history, few names evoke as much adoration and revulsion as O.J. Simpson. Once a golden boy whose swift feet carried him from the dusty fields of his youth to the bright, unforgiving lights of national stadiums. But O.J. loved the attention and the fame. He loved being a living symbol of athletic success. But between the dazzling record-breaking runs, athletic achievements, TV shows and movies, huge endorsement deals, lay a labyrinth of sins. Pride, lust, greed, envy. Sins that couldn't stay in the shadows for forever, and would slowly erode the man the world believed he was. Everyone knows this story, but my hope is to shine a light on some aspects of it that you may not have known. Because I know while researching this, I learned so much I had no idea about. It's been pretty mind-blowing. Tonight we will peel back the layers of celebrity to reveal a tale of triumph, temptation, and tragedy. A journey marked by ambition and marred by vice. This is O.J. Simpson, a true seven deadly sinner, where every glory had its shadows. Sources for this episode include a Washington Post article by Rick Mace, Glenn Frankel, and Matt Schindel, a Huffington Post article by Maxwell Strachan, a Bustle article by Mallory Kara, Wikipedia, and a ton of it is from the documentary O.J. Made in America. And considering that that doc is 5 parts long, with about 1.5 hours per episode, this could very well be a 2-parter, with the beginning being his backstory, first marriage, meeting Nicole, triumphs and tragedies along the way, and most likely ending the episode on the murder or leading up to it. And the second part will include that infamous chase, the trial, the outcome, his later arrest, and imprisonment. The line between hero and sinner in so much of history blurs easily as ink on paper, and O.J. is one of those extremes. As we go through his life, we have to ask ourselves, how did a man who once symbolized, like, just being the American dream, like, first of all, he's a black man in America. Second of all, he, and you're going to see this later, transcends race. He becomes one of the biggest, most successful athletes of all time, record-breaking athletes. But how did his story become such a cautionary tale of a, you know, major ego and moral decay? And frankly, severe anger problems. I do wonder if he had head injuries from football that changed his personality, because it is so weird to see interviews of him where he seems very gentle and like affable and charming and like almost sometimes he can seem cocky, but sometimes he actually seems like gentle, I guess. Is so it is a very strange cautionary tale. But O.J. Simpson was born in 1947 in San Francisco, California. Is Orenthal James Simpson, O.J. for short, and eventually affectionately called the Juice. Simpson was the son of Eunice, who was an orderly at a psychiatric ward, and Jimmy Lee Simpson, a custodian for a Federal Reserve Bank, and a cook. Simpson's maternal grandparents were from Louisiana. His aunt gave him the name Orenthal, which she told him was the name of a French or Italian actor she liked. He was called OJ from birth, and didn't actually know that Orenthal was his given name until a teacher read it in third grade. Simpson had one brother, Melvin. Simpson had one brother, Melvin Leon Truman Simpson, one living sister, Shirley Simpson Baker, and one deceased sister, Carmelita Simpson Durio. And not a lot is said on why his sister passed away, but Simpson grew up in San Francisco and lived with his family in the housing projects of the low-income Portero Hill neighborhood. The projects were converted from an old army base. As a child, Simpson developed rickets and wore braces on his legs until the age of 5, giving him his bow-legged stance. I actually believe, or is it pigeon-toed? Greg, do you know this? I was going to say, they say a lot of amazing athletes are either pigeon-toed or bow-legged, but it is crazy that he
probably
was in
pigeon-toed.
And you're a great athlete. Okay. Well, I walked right into that one. Okay, OJ, with the pride. yeah, I think it is pigeon-toed. I think, yeah, because my nephew, who's a great football player, he's pigeon-toed. And I think that's how I learned that. But regardless, it's pretty crazy that he was in leg braces until the age of 5 and became one of the most unbelievable runners, which we'll go into. So, as a youth, he earned money by scalping tickets and collecting seat cushions at Kaiser Stadium. After his parents separated in 1952, when Simpson was just 4, he and his siblings were raised by their mother alone. She worked very hard, she was very well educated, but money was tight. When it's a single parent household, it's just hard. So early in his teenage years, Simpson joined a street gang called the Persian Warriors, and was briefly incarcerated at the San Francisco Youth Guidance Center. Because he and his buddies grew up in such a poor neighborhood, and they're interviewed a lot in this documentary, and I really love one of his buddies' voices. It's like one of my favorite voices of all time, and we're going to play a little bit of it in a little bit. But because they grew up in such a poor neighborhood, OJ and his friends got into a lot of shady activity. His buddy, who appears in the documentary, says that they would steal cars, break into people's houses, and steal the women's purses. And they would also scalp the tickets at the stadium to earn money. As a youth, he was arrested 3 times. After his 3rd arrest, Simpson happened to meet baseball star Willie Mays, who encouraged the youth to avoid trouble. He said it helped persuade him to reform. But OJ was very good at getting himself out of situations, even if that meant throwing his friends under the bus. So one day in high school, and his buddy's telling this on the documentary, they're playing craps, like rolling dice in the bathroom. And all of a sudden they see these, you know, big black boots like come under the, you know, bathroom door. And they realize that it's their coach, Coach McBride. And he tells them, "I'm taking you to the principal's office." And OJ stays in the back of the pack as they're walking. And he's like, "Coach McBride, you can't do this to us. We'll get suspended. We're all on the football team, etc." But Coach McBride walks them all to the principal's office. And then he walks out. And then Silver Tongue OJ also turns to go. And the principal is like, "OJ, where are you going?" And he's like, "Oh, I was just helping Mr. McBride bring these guys down here." And then he waltzed off, leaving his friends to take the fall. Self-preservation and smooth talk was OJ's forte. He could talk his way out of anything. And so he did, with his best friend Al Collins. And this is how he met his future wife in not the savoriest of ways. Now, the way he got with Marguerite is a true testament to what OJ wants, OJ gets, and pays no consequences for it. Marguerite had been dating Al Collins, OJ's best friend. She was the nice girl from the other side of town. And this is what happens next.
"When we were younger, Al Collins used to stutter. And he never was good with talking to girls. Marguerite was the nice girl from the other side of town. But Marguerite liked Alan. and they wound up going steady.
There was some party, and OJ came and got me. I thought we was going straight to the party, but we pull up in front of Marguerite's house, and he tells me to get in the back. And I'm like in shock, like, you know, I seen her with, you know, walking with Alan. We go down to where the party is, and Alan spots us, and he starts shaking his head, and no, no way. He is furious, and Alan's a big guy. And he grabs the car, and he's rocking the car back and forth, just rocking it. And Marguerite gets out of the car. She says, Alan, stop it. And he stops. We're like, no, he didn't. How can OJ keep getting out of these situations? He stole his best friend's girl. Later on, you see the three of them together.
So that was from the documentary OJ Made in America. So to recap, when OJ was recruited to play in college, OJ had already been married to his high school sweetheart, Marguerite, for 5 months. That wasn't said in that clip, but he ends up marrying her. He really does steal his best friend's girl. It really is a true testament to what OJ wants, OJ gets, and pays no consequences for. Because, like his buddy said, they were as thick as thieves. You'd see Marguerite, Al, and OJ all hanging out together at USC. And I think the part of that clip that is just also a true testament to OJ's ego is they're all playing football. And they are all talking about, like, and his buddy said that they were all braggadocious. And they're all talking about, like, they're going to go pro one day. And OJ says to his friends, one of these days, your children are going to be fighting over who wants to be OJ Simpson. It's humble. Casual, humble. Despite being an incredible football player, Simpson didn't have the grades to go to a D1 school right out of high school. So he played at a junior college for a few years, before being recruited and signed to a scholarship by USC. But also in college, he became a renowned track star. Simpson was an aspiring track athlete, and before playing football at USC, he ran the third leg of a sprint relay quartet that broke the world record. So 2 years after graduating high school, after going to junior college, he was recruited to USC. And under the guidance of coach John McKay, OJ thrived. The plan was simple. Get OJ the ball 39 to 40 times a game. The other team would try and tackle him, and he'd slip past them and get a touchdown. John McKay became sort of a father figure to OJ, saying he was one of the finest boys they may have ever had on their team. He was really able to pull one over on people. He had a winning smile, kind of phony, calm demeanor, but it really wasn't that phony. He was really able to pull it off. But OJ really needed that father figure in his coach. After his parents separated in 1952, when Simpson was 4, he and his siblings were raised by their mother. His father became a well-known drag queen in the Bay Area. And later in life, Jimmy Simpson announced that he was gay. And he died of AIDS in 1986. The deep shame OJ felt over his dad being gay would never leave him. In the doc, one of his friends goes to his dad's apartment, and his dad opens a door in a robe, and then just behind him was another man in a robe. And that was when the friend was like, oh, OJ's dad is gay. Which, like we all know, nothing wrong with being gay. But during that time, huge stigma. I mean, still probably some stigma today, but it's gotten a lot better. But also being gay and black and dressing in drag, I can see how OJ felt some shame over that. But he persevered and kept his head down, like he always did. He was very serious, it seemed like. He was goal-oriented, goal-focused. I will be the most successful. I am the best athlete. I will transcend race. OJ, OJ, OJ. And he knew to bet on OJ because the up-and-coming OJ Simpson was thriving in college. And this would be the game that would change everything. UCLA versus USC, a bid for the Rose Bowl, and USC was down at that point in the game. They were outplaying them, they thought, but they were still down until the run. Just an incredible 64-yard run where he seems to effortlessly glide in and around tacklers before breaking out in, frankly, a poetic run for the touchdown. It is truly fantastic to watch. Jeffrey Toobin, author of The Run of His Life, states that if you were a football fan in the 1960s, the late 1960s, and someone asks you if you remember the run, it was just one run. It was OJ's run. And that set OJ apart from everyone. That single play is still felt to be one of the greatest college plays of all time. He became an instant national star.
First down and more. There's Simpson. Look at that cut. OJ Simpson. That's all she wrote. 64 yards. 64 thrilling, captivating collegiate football yards. And let's look at that one again. Wow.
I don't recall seeing anybody that can turn it on like this boy, Chris. There he is past the line of scrimmage. Watch him read his box downfield now. There's that fast break to the outside. Now he hesitates just a little bit. And as he turns back across the field here, he goes much further than the UCLA defenders, but he's so much faster, it makes no difference.
64 yards.
And we've got, again, a tie game.
And now Ricky Aldridge.
Meanwhile, on the backdrop of the rest of the black community and black athletes of the time, they had no rights. It was the height of the civil rights movement, and many black athletes were standing with their brothers and sisters in this fight. They didn't think they were better than. But OJ made a decision to refrain from taking a stand on civil rights. It stood in sharp contrast to many other star athletes of his era. Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Bill Russell, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They comported themselves as if they believed activism was a necessary part of the assignment. But Simpson sought social status over social justice. He would say, "I'm not black, I'm OJ." Those were Simpson's words, said in response to a civil rights activist and sociologist, Harry Edwards, in the late 1960s, when Edwards was recruiting Simpson, who at the time was a renowned two-sport athlete at USC. Remember, he broke the world record for track. He recruited him to participate in the Olympic Project for Human Rights. But Simpson wanted no part of activism then, and certainly not when he won the Heisman Trophy. 2 months after, John Carlos and Tommy Smith took up the fight, raising their fists on the 200-meter medal podium during the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City in protest of the mistreatment of black people in America. And I distinctly, actually, before I even saw this documentary, Greg, I know that exact shot. I've seen it in probably other documentaries. I mean, I wasn't born in 1968, but...
Of course, it's historic.
Yeah, it's completely, yeah, with a black glove.
Yeah.
It's like a, yeah. That's also going to be something that comes in very interestingly into OJ's trial that we're going to do in part two of this, because what's painfully ironic and kind of disgusting is that OJ at his height wanted no part of being black, really wanted no part of standing with, you know, his black fellow man. And then when he gets arrested, when he's on trial, the black community rallies around him like you can't believe, heartbreakingly so. And one of those kind of Black Panther salutes is going to come into play during his trial. But it's so sad to me that, like, he ditched them when they needed him, but he was certainly willing to take their support when he needed them. Okay, so back on trial. So that was the backdrop playing out as OJ won the Heisman Trophy in 1968. The other major events during this tumultuous time? The turbulence of 1968 began on New Year's Day, with the Tet Offensive shocking Americans with the grim reality that the Vietnam War was not one they could win. Nor did half of America know why they were there. Then the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy darkened the national mood and deepened domestic unrest. Mass protests erupted around the globe from Chicago to Prague to France to Mexico and beyond. In space, Apollo 8 orbited the moon, while back on Earth, McDonald's debuted the iconic Big Mac. And OJ won the Heisman.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face.
It is 20 hours and 12,000 miles to war over the Great Circle route to Benoit Air Base near Saigon. From there comes assignment to an outfit that needs them in the field.
Then I changed my mind and decided, well, some people do come back. I guess I'll take my chances.
So I said, okay, I'm going. That's all there is to it. There's really nothing I can do about it. Then about the last week or so, I really started getting kind of nervous and jumpy there. But now, well, I'm here, so there's really nothing to it. If I get zapped while I'm there, well, the world's not going to stop. So you're going to keep pushing.
In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King.
If there's anything close to hell, it had to be Wade.
Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
The shots started.
Maitre D' reported that Senator Kennedy had been shot.
He's been shot?
That's right.
I just heard this crackling
20 years ago.
And I don't think we have to accept the idea that the stain of bloodshed is going to be ever across our country.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest our rights.
According to the USC Athletics Department, Simpson set a record for total yards, rushed in the NCAA with 1,709, and he beat more than 19 Trojan NCAA and conference records during his 2 years there. For those who don't know football, USC is a football powerhouse. It's life and death. It's actually bigger than that. So playing for the Trojans is a big deal, and Simpson knew that. He said, quote, "The school of my choice was the University of Southern California, and I can't imagine any school educating a guy and preparing him for the world more than USC did me." He said that in his Pro Football Hall of Fame speech in 1985. He said, "They allowed me to play on some great teams there. We won a national championship." It was in college that OJ also began his acting career. In the 1960s and 1970s, OJ appeared on an episode of Medical Center in 1969. He began acting while at USC and appeared on Dragnet in an uncredited role as a potential recruit to the Los Angeles Police Department. He'd become a professional actor before playing professional football, appearing in the first episode of Medical Center as Cicely Tyson's husband, despite being 23 years her junior, while negotiating his contract with the Bills. And before Simpson's murder trial, sports writer Ralph Wiley wrote in 2002, "White people considered Simpson a unifying symbol of all races." History professor Lou Moore said that this made Simpson the first Black athlete to be put on. In 1975, People magazine described Simpson as the first Black athlete to become a bona fide, lovable media superstar. And then came the Hertz commercial. The infamous Hertz commercial. Executives at the rental car company Hertz knew that they wanted to project a potential business traveler in the 1970s with speed, reliability, and efficiency. They quickly realized that one man radiated all those qualities. You couldn't really get like a, you know, just a white actor sort of running around the way OJ does around the airport. They said OJ Simpson is the one. He is the one that radiated all of those qualities. And so they had a slogan, the superstar in a rent-a-car. And he was the current reigning superstar as far as the competition was concerned. The campaign would pay dividends for both the company and its pitchman, who in early Hertz ads was shown racing through the airport terminal, leaping over rope barriers, clutching a briefcase instead of cradling a football. In some of Simpson's later ads, average Janes and Joes cheered him on as he ran, yelling, "Go, OJ, go!" And it was also seen as a way, because most of the people cheering him on were white people, and it was a way to sort of be like, look at this, you know, fast athletic businessman dude, and white people love him. Everyone loves OJ. Everyone loves OJ. Here's some more OJ. It's breakfast time. The juice. You know what I mean?
Nobody does it better than Hertz.
Nobody does it better. Hertz leads the others by far. Nobody does it best for you. Hertz, the superstar.
Nobody has more of what it takes to rid you of Fairmont, Mustang, LTD, or other fine car faster.
Hertz, the superstar.
You know it.
So beyond his acting career, the Buffalo Bills had drafted O.J. Simpson as the first overall draft pick in the 1969 NFL Draft. Simpson ended up playing for the Bills for 9 seasons from 1969 to 1977. But Simpson hated Buffalo. He hated the weather. It was like going to Siberia for him. Coming from sunny USC, this was not ideal. And his first couple seasons were also not ideal. Under the direction of the first coach, who was more into the passing game, OJ couldn't catch a ball to save his life. What he was a powerhouse, a runner. He could sneak around you and push through you and then break out and get a touchdown. So after 2 years in the league and two coaches, it wasn't until 1971 when the Bills hired coach Lou Saban as head coach. And that changed everything for OJ, because Saban believed in the running game, and he made Simpson the centerpiece of the Bills' offense. In 1972, Simpson rushed for over 1,000 yards for the first time in his career, gaining a league-leading total of 1,251 yards. In 1973, Simpson became the first player in history to break the highly coveted 2,000-yard rushing mark, with 2,003 total rushing yards and 12 touchdowns. What's crazy is there's only 9 people that have done that. And his actually was in the like regular season games. And I think that he might be the only one that still has the ones that are just in like the 14 regular season games. I think he still holds that record. Pretty impressive. And then in 1978, he is traded to the San Francisco 49ers, his hometown. And he plays with them for 2 years before making the difficult decision to retire. But he had been building up his acting career the whole time, and he knew that he was going to move to that as his next step. In summary, Simpson gained 11,236 rushing yards, placing him second on the NFL's all-time rushing list when he retired. He now stands at 21st. He was named NFL Player of the Year in 1973 and played in 6 Pro Bowls. He was the only player in NFL history to rush for over 2,000 yards in a 14-game season and the only player to rush for over 200 yards in 6 different games in his career. From 1972 to 1976, Simpson averaged 1,540 rushing yards per 14-game season, 5.1 yards per carry. And now if you're not into sports, this is probably getting a little bit boring, but you get the point. He was an unbelievable athlete. But an athlete that was not without his faults. But while still in the NFL, slowly transitioning out, Simpson appeared in productions such as the television miniseries Roots, 1977, and the dramatic motion pictures The Klansman, The Towering Inferno, The Cassandra Crossing, Capricorn One. He was also a host of Saturday Night Live during its second season and hosted an episode during its third season. Sorry, he was a guest, my bad, during its second season and hosted an episode during its third season. And he was only the second professional athlete to host the show. He also became a big fixture in the Naked Gun series, along Leslie Nielsen. And according to Arnold Schwarzenegger, Simpson was also considered by James Cameron to play the blockbuster character that would be the Terminator. When Schwarzenegger was cast as the character, Cameron ultimately cast him because he thought that, you know, that Simpson seemed a little bit too nice to be seen as the killer in The Terminator. Which is pretty ironic. So it's 1977. OJ is still playing for the 49ers. But he's in LA at a new nightclub called The Daisy. And he meets 18-year-old Nicole Brown. She had just, to put it in perspective, she graduated high school on May 20th, 1977, just one day after turning 18. 3 weeks later, she's working as a waitress at the Daisy. She meets OJ at that nightclub when he was 29 and she was 18. Not a huge age gap, but it kind of puts things in perspective. She would enroll at Saddleback College in Mission Viejo, California that same year, and at the time, she and Simpson were already dating. Meanwhile, Simpson is still married to his high school sweetheart, which he stole from his friend, and has 2 children. He originally had 3. It's very, very, very tragic. One that died in a pool drowning accident. So it's just heartbreak all over the place. What's interesting, though, is in the OJ Made in America documentary, his friend, which his friend has a lot of sympathy for him and heartbreak for him because he knows that feeling. He had also lost a child in a drowning accident that just, they were both toddlers in the same year, I believe. And gosh, that's my worst fear. I'm never going to have a pool. He said he knows that it's still eats away at OJ. OJ was still alive at the time of this documentary. It has to, because it kills this guy every day. But he said OJ was very good at keeping his head down and compartmentalizing and just kind of keeping on. But he said he knew that it probably killed him. And maybe that is, you know, a lot of times they say that it's hard for, you know, couples to stay together after the loss of a child. Maybe that is why he wanted to date an 18-year-old blonde. I don't know. But OJ does what OJ wants. So he's at this nightclub and Nicole's their waitress. And, you know, she was described by his buddy that was with him as like fun and bright and bubbly and smart. And she was described by everyone like that. Sometimes she was described as shy, I think but she was 18. Like, what 18-year-old isn't kind of shy? And OJ looks at his buddy and he says, "I'm going to marry that girl." OJ, you're still married currently, but we'll get there. But yeah, she's 18, he's 29. and they begin dating. But the red flags start pretty much from the jump, and I found this horrifying, and I showed it to Greg, and he also found it absolutely horrifying. After they go out on their first date.
She had just graduated from high school. She was just like my little sister. She goes, I met this man, and his name is O.J. Simpson. They went out, and I waited up for them. She got home. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and her jeans were ripped. And I went, what happened? And she goes, well, he was a little forceful. And I go, Nicole, why would you let him first date be a little bit forceful? Well, Dave, don't be upset. I think I really like this guy. That was, you know, the start of it.
I just find that so heartbreaking and shocking. And that, yeah, that's a clip from her best friend, Dave LeBon, in the documentary OJ Made in America. It's just like, that was the first date? And in next episode, you're going to hear how quickly it escalates into far worse abuse, coercive control, stalking. The list goes on. And yeah, I think we'll end there because this story is so many layers. And poor, sweet, bright light Nicole, like, I mean, you're going to hear at her funeral the way was actually one of OJ's buddies that became her buddy, like, describes her. He said when she got laughing, she could not stop laughing. Like, she just seemed like an adorable bundle of joy that, you know, anyways, well, thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show. And if you are, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And we may have some special interviews for this series. But stay tuned on that. Again, they are very possible interviews. It is a person I knew 14 years ago in LA who was actually a pretty major part of this case, much older than me, but someone that some older friends or whatever would take us to dinners with. So I'm gonna see if I can track him down. I couldn't find his phone number on my phone anymore, but yeah, we'll see if that works out, because I think that could be very, very interesting. So stay tuned, and I love you guys. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.